like to, you know, profile in front. And then the jukes go down all at once. They like, don't get mad, don't get mad, don't get mad, don't get mad.
Microphone check. Hip-hop from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly.
I'm Ali Shaheed Muhammad.
And Ali is our guest for today.
I was going to say, who's our special guest?
It's you, bro.
What up, world? For the 50th episode,
oh, yeah.
You wanted to interview me, and I was like, wow, that's dope. I was thinking about something like that. It'd be a great idea.
Okay, you know? So two things. A, you were thinking about it before I mentioned it. B, this is when it gets embarrassing for me, because I can't count. And we have passed our 50th episode.
Whoops.
This is going to be...
51 and a half?
Honestly, it's like 54 or something really
nice.
Egregious.
Microphone check is growing up.
I know. We couldn't wait for the 100th, though.
Why not?
I don't know. Well, once we started talking about it, it seemed like something that needed to happen.
I'm here. I'm down.
You said something in an interview that we did with Rodney Carmichael of Creative Loafing. And you said that when you get on the plane, you worry, you like, what, how did you say it?
Well, I make a prayer when I step my foot on the airplane.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember exactly what I said, but you just never know if this will be your last time, the last moment, which is, I'm sure everyone has that feeling.
For sure.
When they fly. So I just say a little prayer. And I don't know, the more I fly, the more I think about, did I do everything I was supposed to do?
Yeah. And so you think about this interview.
I thought about this interview because the 25th anniversary of the release of The People's Instinctive Travels in the Paths of Rhythm. Yeah,
I nice said job. It.
we just passed that. And in thinking and knowing that we were nearing the date, it really, I began to think about just the things that I've done in the past 25 years. And there's a lot that has not been said.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's still a lot more that I want to do.
Right.
So, and just thinking about that, I felt like, well, it would be cool to leave something behind. In addition to the music, it's something that may be able to help people, not only from a music perspective, but just in life.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a little nervous. Oh, I am. As we were thinking about doing this, I'm like, man, I hope we get this in before I don't have the opportunity.
Right. Well, what hasn't been said?
Well, good question. There's a lot that hasn't been said. I don't know. It depends on, you have to ask the right question. I have a whole lot of thoughts, and I guess really it just depends on the question and the setting and what's going on. Like, for an example, when the actual release date of the first album came, there were a lot of people just showing love for A Tribe Called Quest and making postings on Facebook and Twitter. And so it's like, just to say thank you didn't seem like enough.
You mean for you to say thank you back to the fans?
Yeah, thank you to the fans. Like, oh, you know, 25 years, thanks. Like, that's, it just seemed it didn't seem like enough for people who have dedicated, you know, that amount of time into your artistry. And so that got me to thinking, well, instead of just posting a simple thanks, and it would not have been the tonation, it would have been like, thank you, oh my God.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say something more on what I learned in 25 years. And as I was writing that, I realized I learned a lot and I still forgot a lot of stuff that I've learned. And then I didn't want to write too much. And so I was like, well, what really matters? And then in that moment, it's like, have you ever written a will?
No, but I weirdly was thinking about it like two nights ago.
Okay, the lawyers will ask you, like, so if this happens, then how do you want to deal with this? And should this group of people that you've chosen to deal with this in this way, what happens if this person is not here or this happens in this? And it's like a maze. And something that is as simple as, I just want my stuff to be placed in the good hands or something.
Yeah.
When I'm no longer here, becomes like a whole bunch of thoughts. So in writing that posting, it became, well, what is the most pertinent thing that if today your life ended, what, you know, something that I felt mm-hmm. was valuable I could leave. So I made my posting. So when you ask me that question, my mind thinks of a whole lot of things that have not been said. And I don't know if I will get to say it or if I repeat myself. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think that you demand a lot of yourself, and I think that one of the reasons that Tribe is so valued and has been so strong for so long is that, like, as a group, you were demanding of yourselves. I think that one of the things that comes up on our show a lot is that you demand a lot of hip-hop culture and musicians. And sometimes that can cause frustration.
Hmm.
Is there anything that, and you know, I think we're both sort of wary of, like, I'm younger than you, but I'm still old. And I feel a little bit old man about some things in hip hop. And people will try to paint the girl in the room into that corner as well. But is there anything that you want, that you would like to see happen in hip hop that just isn't happening?
Well, one, I think that having a woman's perspective is important. And so when you say they paint the girl in a room, I think that that's true. And maybe, I don't know if you're stating that in a positive or maybe not so positive way, but I think that's really important because we, you know, men and women, we're here together. And the struggles that, you know, the hip hop forefathers were going through was not just one-sided in terms of, you know, one sex. So it's important even still to this day, as far as hip hop has come, that there, the woman's voice is, it should be heard. You know, so there's that. I do demand a lot of myself, certainly, and on the culture and the art form, I do have a view or a set of requirements, I think, that authenticates one's artistry.
Okay.
Under the culture of hip hop.
What are they?
Education, knowledge, value in self, value in community, advancement of community, advancement of self, unity, peace, certainly, and to stand up against oppression and oppressive things, and honesty and clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that is a tall order for most 16-year-olds. This is a tall order for most 35-year-olds.
I think that's because the age that we live in now, the bar to be higher in consciousness and self is so low these days.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, to say that's it's tall order for a 16-year-old, I don't think so, you know, because obviously we did it and there were so many others, and not just within the decade of the 90s, but you can go back a couple thousand years, that there have been the young-minded people who have made changes, you know, great changes to culture and the way that humanity has advanced.
So you don't think that you and your, like, peers are on a higher level, are, like, are geniuses of a kind?
I think that there are some people who vibrate higher, certainly. I'm not going to throw that around. That's left for other people to decide or to say. But I think that the rappers now who are 16, they've been given so much, and they have a lot of privileges, but at the same time, they are overexposed. And so the way that they manage that information of being overexposed may be disappointing to someone like myself at times. And I think not to really fault them, but really, you know, if you're leaving the world in a mess, you can't blame the next generation for how they are dealing with the mess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, I don't really have this, like, harsh judgment against, you know, those kids who haven't been able to meet my requirements, but I certainly am not going to lower the standard because they have not been challenged
mm-hmm.
properly, because they have the ability, they have the knowledge to know that nothing new is on the earth right now.
Yeah.
Technology, the things that we're discovering, it's been sitting here just waiting for someone to brush it off and go, oh, let me read that. Let me see how I can use this information. And it doesn't matter if it's from a tech perspective or a philosophical perspective. So it's just a matter of challenging and not lowering the bar. But I'm an artist, and I don't use that judgment to not give anyone an opportunity.
No, I get it.
You know, so perfect example. One of the reasons why I was open to this interview is because I know what we do here at Microphone Check, and I know that you would ask the right questions, you know, and allow for me to just say what hasn't been said. And so the same way that we operate Microphone Check in a non-judgmental way and trying to be unbiased and fair, I'm the same way as an artist, but don't get it twisted. Yes, I do feel that, you know, stuff is whack. It's whack as whack. KRS said it so many, it's like, you know, but there's a platform. And then you hold up the honest versus the a little less than honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the universal truth is that most people see what's going on. There isn't a whole lot right now that we can do to change, like, who's getting money, basically. But I think the universal adage, real recognize real.
Mm-hmm.
Is quietly appropriate more than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Hip-hop has had this history of where the predecessor just is so harsh and not nice to, you know, the next coming generation.
Right.
That it creates this separation and this gap, and therefore the younger, the older or old school, whatever, vet, whatever you want to throw in there, doesn't really respect the art of the younger. And likewise, then the younger generation doesn't really wholly respect or appreciate what was here before them. So it just creates this unnecessary divide. And so I'm not looking to do that, but at the same time, it's kind of a, it's hard to challenge someone from a younger perspective who thinks they know it all and that they have, their way is the right way.
Yeah.
You know, so you, it's a delicate process and you don't want to kind of talk down to them. So I've been in a good position, I think, because I do have respect for another person's vision. But at the same time, if it's garbage, or if it's, I'm going to use the word garbage, trash is the new word of right now. If it's trash, it's trash.
To all the people who can quest like a tribe does. Before this, did you really know what live was? Comprehend to the track force, why? Cuz getting mentions on the tip of the vibe buzz. Rock and roll to the beat of the funk fuzz. Wipe your feet really good on the rhythm rug. If you feel the urge to freak, do the jitterbug. Come and spread your arms if you really need a hug. Afrocentric living is a big shrug. A life filled with, that's what I love. A lower plateau is what we're above. If you diss us, we won't even think of. We'll nip of the dog and give a big shove. This rhythm really fits like a snug glove. Like a box of positives, it's a plus love. As the trial flies high like a dove.
What do you think would happen if you guys put out People's Instinctive today?
I think that right now, 2015, this would be an excellent time to put an album like that out, because I believe that through, if you look at the record sales, we're in a time period where there's a lot of confusion for those who have had success and have had this complacent sort of involvement with the way they've been received and life has been good, you know, and not really challenging the artistry, just doing like the same cookie cutter sort of routine. And so it's reflected in the record sales. People are not really engaging. It's reflecting in the marketing campaigns. There's a limited amount of enthusiasm for artists from when I know I was 19. Like, there was so much that was out and you're excited about everything. And now we're at the point that I think people are looking, the writers are looking, the A&R departments are looking, managers are looking for that next thing. What's that cool thing, you know? So an album like, and I think the same thing sort of happened when we came out. Like, there was sort of a sound in the hip-hop that was happening that was just across the board the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like that new next thing that came out that was weird.
Yeah.
But over time, it was like, wow, that's different. And it's cool. And it was embraced because it offered something good likened to that which came before it, but different. So I think I'd like to think that if this album were to come out now, it would get the same reception. It wasn't like we came on the scene and we hit the charts. Similarly to De La Soul with Me, Myself, and I, it was just like instant hit, you know, and they did really well. For us, we had to work for it.
Right, and you've told me that you broke in Europe first.
Yeah, we broke in Europe before we broke here in the U.S. So that was a lot of hitting the pavement, doing a lot of grassroots sort of things, and performing in places when we were not known,
mm-hmm.
and continuing to do so and continuing to, we did take advantage of the Jungle Brothers, you know, and that door that was opened by them for us, but we certainly worked it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what was your guys' relationship back then? Was it very business? Did you know what you were doing? Or was it like, we have a good idea and we're going to ride this as far as we can?
We were around. When we began, we had a vision in terms of what we wanted to do musically and what that really meant from a business perspective wasn't wholly realized, but as we were going through the process from recording our demo, because things really began there, Geffen Records, actually Jeff Finster from Geffen, who used to work at Geffen, had given us a demo deal. And so it was at that point that there was this excitement of, oh, wow, we really get to maybe do this professionally, what we've been doing in our bedrooms, came with the, there's a certain, I guess, you know, order of, okay, going to the studio. Well, in going to the studio, there's a schedule. You have to, you know, like, so even something as simple and basic as, like, in New York, and I was going to BMCC, so, and I was working. And so it was like, okay, we have to figure this out. And even something as simple as that, it began to get the feel of seriousness.
What was your job?
Oh, man. I went from working at this messenger service for lawyers to working in the stock room of the first Cole Haan store in New York City on Madison Avenue. Man, the times we had in that basement.
What do you mean?
And because the stock room was in the basement area of the building, so it was me and like maybe four other guys at the time, like two of them. One of them was one of my best friends who went to Mary Bertram High School. And then another one was a younger classman who went to Bertram. And then there were two more, or maybe three more kids from the Bronx. And we used to just have fun down there. Like, we worked, but it was fun.
I worked at a shoe store.
You worked at a shoe store?
In high school, yeah. I worked at a Steve Madden in Georgetown.
I don't know what Steve Madden is.
Don't even worry about it. But yeah, the stock room was in the basement too, and that was a lot of dirt went down.
Yeah, well.
It was all girls. It was different dirt, but yeah.
It's just a lot of fun. But to kind of take it back to, you know, your question of, did we realize, you know, the business aspect on at an early age? It began to shape up as we were recording and, I guess, engaging in other conversations with the record company, in terms of marketing, in terms of what the expectations were. When I signed the deal when I was 18, I knew absolutely nothing about a publishing deal. What that meant, it was a lot of money. I knew at the time that we signed a deal that no group who had never sold records had signed for that amount of money. So there was all these things, but you didn't really know what it meant, but it was a matter of need to figure it out. And so much that DJ Red Alert, who was our manager at the time, we felt that we might need someone with a bit more clout. Now, you have to understand, Red Alert had as like all the clout in New York City at that time. And for someone in his position who was ruling New York radio.
Can we, like, is there any analogous figure today to him?
Funkmaster Flex.
You think Flex breaks people, though?
He did at some point, absolutely. Yeah,
but like... Not
to the degree that Red Alert, no, because Red Alert, and I think it had a lot to do with the Jungle Brothers. Like, it was, well, no, I shouldn't say that, because, I mean, he, Boogie Down Productions.
Right, he predates, yeah.
Yeah, so.
I just want people to understand what it really meant in, like, today's terms.
I don't think there's really a comparison because up until that point, like, hip-hop didn't really exist on radio.
Yeah.
It did in a very small, like, very just narrow vacuum.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really anyone else doing what Red Alert did. Maybe DJ Clue did, you know, like later on in breaking and discovering people from, you know, a air personality perspective. And I'm trying to think who else in the now.
If there isn't anybody.
So, yeah, you're right. And so Red Alert, and that's why I'm bringing it up, is that he had all the power in terms of New York hip hop. And for us to understand that we needed something larger, even though we didn't know what it was, but just moving forward, you know, again, we're looking at the greats of Jimi Hendrix, the Beatles, the Doors, Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, you know, Miles Davis, Cannonball Adderley, like giants. Mm-hmm. That's all we knew, you know, like we grew up listening to giants and we wanted our music to be presented in the same fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that Red did everything to bring us to that point, but we needed something else. Didn't know what that was, but we figured it out. So that all happened at the age of 18, 19. The Native Tongues, we used to go out to clubs and hang out and have the best time. Like, oh my God. Like, every time we got together, you know, if you listen to the lyrics of Buddy by De La Soul, like, it is literal. Very literal.
Listen to this disc jockey's introduction to Madhavani's Lazy Gandhi. One's about the KOs, the knockouts out there who I call my buddy.
Hold up,
wait a minute.
Now just wait, we're gonna talk about Buddy on this plate. But before we let the herd out the gate, make sure all the levels are straight out.
The jungle, the brothers.
De La Soul, on a roll. Black medallions, yeah. No gold. Hanging out with bars, hanging out with mates. Buddy, y'all in my face.
Fold the lap. Jim Browski must wear a cap, just in case the young girl likes to clap. Ain't for the win, but before I begin, I initiate the body with a slap.
I drop the beat, for the fighting from a tribe called Quest. When I see Buddy, I will never half step. I just do her tribal style and then check. The buddy that I like is to be sexy and nice, just good enough for the one they call Fife. A brown skinned buddy with shoulder length hair, nice front breast and a round area.
For the next, I'm the keeper from a tribe called Quest. And if you quest for the buddy, don't fess. If the Jimmy wants nothing but the best.
The best?
The best. Let's stick out the Jimmy and see what we can catch.
Stick him up, Jimmy.
Next, won't be needed unless
Jimmy wanna get back to the flesh.
Dancing on the dance floor. Girl, it's you that I adore. Step off stage, just scream for more. Native tongue, got rhymes galore. Snap my fingers, make you I'll snap a second time. After that, I guarantee you will be standing next to me.
Flop.
And the Jungle Brothers and De La Soul, they kind of preceded us, you know, by a few months in terms of, like, recording an album and putting music out. So for us, we were kind of, like, late, but we were still in the same. We were there together doing the exact same thing. But in looking more at De La, De La definitely had this business sense about them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were making moves that we thought was a little aggressive.
Okay.
But it,
like what?
It began just like their choice of management and just their movement and in terms of having like this family sort of vibe, but it was family, but it was also business. So we stopped hanging out in clubs, and I think that probably disappointed the Native Tongues a little bit just in terms of our access.
Why did you stop?
Because it was business. It was like we could keep playing and dancing in the clubs. I mean, not to say we don't dance and hang out and have fun, but it was just what we did all the time. And it was like, nope, let's get in the studio. The dream is here. It's a reality. And that became the focus.
Right. But do you think that's a part of, like, is it a thing that happens to everybody? Like, it's a natural sort of shedding of childish things, putting down childish things?
Eventually. I think it's inevitable. You go out when you're 19 or whatever, and you're just having the time of your life, and you should, in that experience, you know, being exposed to the world in a way that might not happen. For some people, it never happens. You know, you can live a long life and never be exposed to those certain environments, and or it could happen later on. So, but to experience that at such a young age, yeah, enjoy it, party. But it's inevitable. It's inevitable if you're like making a lot of money, and then it's not there. You turn around, you're like, I signed a deal for how much? I did this. I did what? I toured. Where did it all go? And when the reality factor hits, it's like, well, you did that, but then you also went here, you spent this, you know, you had such a good time bringing all these people. And something that you want to do, you want to, you know, let the community, your neighborhood, get a taste, so you bring people on the road, you're flying people. It's just all these things that's well and good and fun, but in business, it's not practical.
Mm-hmm.
So then you start looking at spreadsheets because everyone gets a business manager throwing, oh, you signing a deal? Come, let me introduce you to my business manager. You're like, yeah, sounds good. I got a business manager going to pay my bills. Yeah, it's great. And then when you find out what that really means, you're like, oh, my God. But these things, it's business. You're looking at ledgers. You're talking about insurance for touring and, yeah, it'll
sober you up quick.
Yeah, it will. Business, you know. And some people have business, you know, they have a nature of business, and some people it's just not for them.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What if your work ethic, I guess I'll call it, comes from your faith? And also your list of standards, your demands?
That's a good question. I think if it were up to my faith, how would I say this? Islam definitely inspires discipline. It inspires consistency.
Okay.
And that consistency is a challenge for me. Discipline is not. Consistency, and the reason why I say that is, like for an example, you know, making prayer 5 times a day, like that's establishes routine and mm-hmm. consistency. So from that I can do, you know, and having certain fundamental consistencies in business can do. But time management, outside of that, that's where that's a challenge.
Listen, you just need an assistant. I don't know how many times I can say that.
Yeah, I did today. Sat down on the edge of my bed and was like, I can't do this anymore.
You don't have to do it by yourself.
I definitely need. I need a clone.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's then you the gotta problem. Like train somebody and manage somebody, give everybody your passwords. That's a mess.
That's the problem. But in terms of how it inspires discipline and consistency, and that's definitely helpful. It has been helpful for me in applying. It doesn't matter whether it's in the studio or outside of the studio and talking to marketing team and managers and promoters and production teams for stage or a production team for the studio. I think you get certain results if you can have that sort of consistency and discipline and clarity and also asking how you can be service of the people who are there, who actually work for you. And you don't think like that when you're 19. I certainly didn't think like that when I was 25 or 29. It does. It's something that acquires over time. But with regards to Islam, it definitely, I mean, I don't know. I walk a different walk than probably a lot of different people in the industry. I'm not saying it like I'm better. I'm in no way any better or a saint, but people can depend on me. Mm-hmm. They do. And they call me the voice of reason. And I suppose that my faith has something to do with that. I know my mom has a lot to do with that. She's a very spiritual, but also logical. Mm-hmm. Person.
I've seen you interact with people that are in an odd way, like closeted Muslims.
Yeah.
What's that all about? I mean, it seems like some people converted when they were locked up. Mm-hmm. Other people, like, I don't know if they were raised mm-hmm. in that faith or not. But there is kind of this, like, under-the-table connection between musicians that most people aren't aware of. I mean, do you have feelings about that? People who, like, kind of keep their faith under wraps? Or do you see it sort of bubble up in ways in people's music?
I think I've seen both sides. It has bubbled up, even if you look at A Tribe Called Quest, it definitely bubbled up, to use that phrase, in the Beats, Rhymes, and Life album. Mm-hmm. And even for, like, Mos Def, Brother Yassin, it bubbles, and at least from a hip-hop perspective, because there's a lot of jazz musicians who are also Muslim. And I'm sure they had experienced the same sort of challenges that we from hip-hop have experienced. But because for them, their artistry and their communication is through the instrument and not necessarily through words or through the same sort of spotlight that the after effects are different. Mm-hmm. So then I understand why others cover their beliefs. And
could you be, like, more direct about that?
Yeah.
What's the price?
Well, I still struggle with it. You know, as you learn more about what matters in life, mm-hmm. Sometimes, and you look at it, I know I have, and say, this music is nothing. And it's weird for a person who has a sort of a spiritual awareness, and I'm not just associating that with Islam, but just a real higher spiritual sort of journey and path, when you look at music and to the degree that people worship music, you go, it's nothing. Mm-hmm. It means nothing. It is nothing. And so...
Or like the musician is hero.
Yeah, the musician is hero. The musician is everything. The
savior.
Savior, exactly. And in a bigger scheme of life, it's nothing. Like, music is an important thing of energy. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of wonderful aspects that come with it in vibrations, the physical vibrations and movement of notes through, you know, an instrument and creating a wave that resonates into our spirit. There's something really powerful about it. And mm-hmm. but it's within that, that whatever it is that I'm saying is powerful, it can be used for good, it can be used against good. Mm-hmm. And so someone who has a belief system, and specifically Islam, where Islam doesn't really embrace music,
right,
then that becomes that individual person's struggle. And it's no different than it, if it's like something as basic as trying to stick to Lent, you know, during mm-hmm. during the time of Lent, or simply doing onto others as you would have them do onto you. Like, there's all these challenges. Or like, go to the ultimate first commandment where the Creator says, you know, do not worship anyone.
No false idols.
No false idols. And so that's a hurdle, right? So are we worshiping the music? And so in Islam, where you have certain rappers who keep it to themselves, it's like, it's hard enough to deal with that struggle on your own and mm-hmm. trying to figure out where do you stand. That has absolutely nothing to do with your fans. It has nothing to do with anyone else. It's just you in existence. Like, where do I stand? And knowing that I am an artist, knowing that I actually love that vibration of energy in a form of communicating, in a way to get my thoughts across, in a way to ask questions, in a way to challenge society, in a way to question some of the things that we experience together, in a way to just throw everything to the wind because I want to have a good time under the helm of music. And then to do that in the public is even worse, and it can rip an artist apart, because then you're under the ridicule of, aren't you Muslim? Don't you believe in this? What you're doing goes against, and it's just like, yeah, I already know everything you're saying to me, you know. I don't know if anyone else gets that sort of scrutiny.
Yeah.
So I do understand why people keep it to themselves.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit, it's related to something that came up when we talked to J. Cole in the winter.
Yeah.
About why people don't make public stands, like physically put their body in places past saying something in the studio. And he said that not everybody knows what to say and is really worried about fucking it up.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, I don't really know how to ask this question, but we've spoken a lot over the past, like, more than a year, I guess, about how, like, what counts as protest music, what we ask of, you know, our artists, our leaders, our writers, what kind of burden we're putting on people unfairly, and what your perspective on it kind of surprised me, because I think that a lot of people think of Tribe's music as political, quote unquote, but that really isn't, you don't put that I mean, I think the way that you've talked about it to me is that it's more of that art doesn't do, art reflects.
It does. And as much as people often say that Tribe's music is political, it's Tribe's music was also fun. Mm-hmm. And so we try to offer balance. Mm-hmm. And so in the art, there are those who choose to offer just one perspective. For an example, if you grew up as a drug dealer and then you are now a recording artist making a lot of money, as a recording artist, there's so much of your life that's different now. Mm-hmm. And so you have to tell the story of where you come from. But and there's many ways to do that, you know, and there could be, because of lack of whatever you want to call it, opportunity, or it just is the way it was. And so you speak of the lifestyle in a very glorious way. It can only be one way. That's not really being complete. And we all know, whether you're a drug dealer or not, like, there's usually just two places that you end up. You either wind up in jail or dead from it. So if every story is going to be fantastical, do you line it up with that aspect, or is it just such a glorification of how much money you make, and then it becomes so egotistical? So there's that mirror, mm-hmm. you know, but then there is a different mirror where you offer something a little bit more balanced. So in that, the art is telling the story of what's happening around it. And as a result of that, it can be the inspiration for change.
Okay.
Or it can be the inspiration for perpetuating ignorance and a lack of change.
Myths.
Yeah.